I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. This Monday is Memorial Day, when we honor the men and women who have died in wars and service to our country. There will be parades with veterans and marching bands and Boy and Girl Scout troops in communities across the country to mark the day, followed by cookouts and picnics. There are still soldiers, Marines, special forces engaged in combat in the Middle East, Afghanistan, in countries in Africa. We don't hear much about what they're doing until someone is seriously injured or has been killed. We asked Marine Corps Sergeant Tim Wynn to join us. He's a mentor coordinator at the Philadelphia Veterans Court. He's also on the national training team for Justice for Vets. He's also a proud graduate of Veterans Court. He served a tour of duty in Iraq in 2003. And Tim Wynn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
What are you doing on Memorial Day?
Memorial Day, I'll actually be in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, with an organization called Shamrock Reigns, which they do equine therapy for veterans and first responders. So we'll be marching in the parade actually with our horses. So it's going to be a fun day.
It's funny, I was doing some research for today's show, and I kept running into articles saying Memorial Day is not Veterans Day. Veterans Day is not Memorial Day. Memorial Day, and yet we keep confusing the two.
Yeah, I think, it's a common misconception in society that people think they feel the need to thank people for their service on Memorial Day. And that's definitely not what it's about. Most people throw parties and have fun and stuff like that. But for us, it's about getting out, you know, such as being in a parade and actually honoring the ones that didn't come back.
Do you feel sad on Memorial Day?
Sure, I always do. I think, that day just has a sort of an aura around it where it's like, you know, for anyone that served in the military, especially those that live with sort of survivor's guilt, which is a common thing amongst veterans, you know, they think about the people that they lost. So it's a tough day for a lot of people.
What's it like to march in the parade?
Well, for me, it's getting together with, you know, the veterans that are still around here, still able to march in a parade, and just to get together, and like I said, I rather honor the ones that didn't come back with my fellow veterans because I know it's tough on them, and to be together with them and get them through the day, and you know, it's just important to be together that day. So
because it is a reminder, right?
It is, absolutely.
You were in Iraq in 2003, so early on in the war.
Yeah, for the initial invasion, I was there. We were actually in Kuwait before it even started, and then they had the shock and awe campaign, which many people watched on TV, and then being a Marine, one of the first to enter the country of Iraq. So,
and then you came back, obviously, after your tour, and you've written about this in blogs and have been interviewed as well, is that you struggled coming back stateside.
Absolutely. Transition out of the military. At that time, we were fighting two wars, the two longest wars in U.S. history, and we ran them side by side. So when I got back to my base in North Carolina, it was pretty much dead there. It was empty. Everyone was out fighting these wars.
Right.
So the transition was fast. And, I was back in Philadelphia within 72 hours. And 4 days later, I was actually arrested for aggravated assault.
Right.
So
I mean, you had a number of arrests. I mean, it sounds like you were struggling. Were you struggling with the aftermath of the war, the fact that you came home to kind of an empty base, that there was no one there
for you? I think a little bit of both. I think transition in any platform, whether it's even getting a new job or starting a new school for people, transition is hard. But when you come out of a war environment and come back into society and the pace is different and, you really can't talk to people about that because they haven't been through it. And it's not their fault. You know, I couldn't talk to my mother. I couldn't talk to friends. So it was hard to actually communicate what I was feeling to get my emotions out. So I struggled and I turned to the bottle. I turned to drugs and it led me down a very dark road.
Were you angry?
Absolutely. I think anger comes with it. And that anger comes from not being able to get your emotions out and bottling all that up. And, anger is definitely a big issue with veterans returning from war.
As you said, you went down a pretty dark road. How dark was that road?
Well, 7 arrests in a year of my life in prison. I had a daughter at the time who I wasn't in her life for the first 4 years because I was, in and out of prison. So it was a very, very dark time in my life. But, there's something called veterans courts that I think we're going to talk about.
We are.
They're able to turn veterans' lives around, and it's very important.
So how did you, after serving some time in prison and being arrested, how did you end up in front of a judge in Veterans Court?
So I actually had 18 months clean and sober at the time. And, you know, just because people put the drugs or the alcohol down, if they don't address mental health issues, they can still struggle with things. And, you know, with 18 months clean and sober, I got another arrest. We'll call it a road rage incident. Oh. And at this time, I didn't know what a Veterans Court was, but Philadelphia had got theirs in 2010. And, you know, I was told by the public defender I was going to go into this program. And when I got there, you know, I really didn't know what I was getting into. But when I walked in a room and I looked to my left and my right and I saw veterans just like me dealing with the same issues, we all had a mission again in our lives. And that mission now was recovery. So it instantly took me back to my time in the military, and I had great success in the program.
How much of Veterans Court is treatment, is mental health treatment?
I would say it's 50%. You know, you have to be engaged. There's a common misconception out there that these courts are a slap on the wrist for veterans. And that is not the case by any stretch of the imagination. Veterans that come into this program, they work and they work hard. You have to go to treatment. You have to go to mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, if that's part of your treatment plan. So it's a combination of a lot of things, but there's also the mentor program, which I'm currently the mentor coordinator of.
Right.
You have the VA, you have the Department of Behavioral Health, you have all these resources right there in one room, and that's what creates the success for these veterans.
As you said, it was a road rage incident that brought you to Veterans Court. How was that addressed?
So I began anger management, and I also started going to a program called Healing Ajax, which is a peer-to-peer support program. And I thrived there because I was reintroduced to veterans who went through the same experiences I went through. I wasn't forced to sit in a room with somebody who had not been in combat and try to steer me in the right direction. I was surrounded by peers, and mm-hmm. we recovered at our own pace. We weren't forced to talk about anything. Peer-to-peer support is the key to success in Veterans Court.
Because of shared experiences, or you speak a common language, you sort of, you know things instinctively about each other?
Absolutely. I think a lot of times we can finish each other's sentence. And you can't, when you're in a room full of veterans, there's nothing you can say where the veterans in the room are going to look around and go, wow, what's wrong with this guy?
Uh-huh.
You know, we just get it. We understand each other. We deal with the same things. So
what was it like? I mean, for you, I guess, to deal with largely, I guess, the trauma of war, did you have, quote-unquote, PTSD, would you say?
Yes. The VA had diagnosed me with that, but when I came back in 2003, their answer was to give me prescription medication. And it was easy to get. When I wanted more, I went and got more. That was their response at first.
Not talk therapy or someone to talk to?
No, it was, in order to get an appointment at the VA at that time, you had to wait, you know, sometimes 3 to 6 months. Because there was such an influx of veterans coming back. I'm happy to report they have changed that. They have done a lot to, you know, rectify those problems. But at that time, the answer was medication. And it, again, led me down a very dark road.
Yeah. You're a mentor. So when you see veterans coming into the courtroom now, do you see yourself? Do you
Absolutely.
Recognize yourself?
Every single week, there's a younger version of me walking through the door.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes an older version of me. You know, you got a lot of Vietnam vets out there who, after years and years of, you know, being out on the street, using substance to get through the day, now that these courts are established, they're getting an opportunity to come in and actually turn their lives around after 40, 50 years.
In fact, I know in Philadelphia and other cities, there has been a big effort to try to get veterans off the street, and particularly Vietnam veterans off the street who, you know, decades after that war have got to be well into their, if not old age, nearly old age.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I'm sure we all see them when we're walking around Philadelphia.
Sure. I mean, we've actually even had a World War II vet in our court.
Really?
Yeah, he was, he had some issues with dementia and he was off his medication and he actually pulled a weapon on a neighbor. So, I mean, we've seen every generation. I mean, but the Vietnam vets, they're, I like to think them as our older brothers and sisters, for that matter. And, they didn't get the same treatment that we got when we came home. So, we owe them big time as far as I'm concerned. to do all we can to, even if they have a short time left on this planet, we owe it to them to help them out.
As you said, when veterans get together, they know how to talk to each other, I guess, know how to listen without judgment or maybe shock, surprise. Does that mean that us civilians, we just don't, there are things we do not understand?
I would say there's things that you don't understand. I don't even know if that's the right term to use, but I think if civilians educate themselves, if they actually look into it, if they care enough to research veterans' issues, you know, you can actually go on justiceforvets.org to their website, and you know they have different a thing called psych armor, which is something that teaches you about veterans' issues. And what veterans courts are and different things that veterans deal with. So there's plenty of resources on a national level, local level, that you can educate yourself about veterans issues. And we all know somebody that served in the military. Yep. We all have an aunt, an uncle, a cousin, whoever. It's up to us to, as a society, to learn about this and to help our veterans.
The head of Veterans Court in Philadelphia is Judge Dugan. When you appear before him, what is that like?
It was a game changer for me knowing that man, he's an Iraq and Afghanistan veteran. He's an old 82nd Airborne paratrooper back in the 80s, and then he was a civil affairs officer, a JAG officer. So he speaks that language. He gets it. He knows how to talk to us. You know, the man, he changed my life. There's no doubt about it. I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for him.
Wow.
And he was the judge in my case, you know. So I stepped in front of him as a defendant, and now I work for him every single day, so it's pretty unique, and it's just an incredible experience.
Is it because he had served and you felt you were in a safe place that would understand you, or was there something he particularly said to you that made such a difference?
I felt comfortable talking to him because I knew he was a veteran. He was actually still in the reserves when I was coming through court. He recently retired, I guess, about over a year ago, but I felt comfortable speaking to him, and you know, the compassion that the man has as a judge, it's, you know, He just relates to us, and he's firm, but he's fair, and we appreciate that. We know how to take orders, and he gives out orders.
That does help, right?
You know, but I mean, it's just everybody likes Judge Dugan. I mean, it's you'd be hard pressed to find someone who doesn't like the man. So even the defendants that are standing in front of him, just the compassion he has and the knowledge that he has, he's just a good person.
Can you imagine then in 2004 where you would be today?
Not at all. I didn't think I'd be sitting here today. I didn't think I would make it, to be honest with you. There was times where I thought I'm probably not going to live too much longer. So, but I'm happy to be here today. I'm out of that darkness, and I'm continue to work. I continue to help veterans every single day, and help them get to the point where I'm at. You know, no two stories are exactly the same, but I can use my story to help somebody else through their own story. So.
Well, I really appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Tim Nguyen, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And he's Marine Corps Sergeant Tim Nguyen, again, mentor coordinator at Philadelphia Veterans Court. He's also on the national training team for Justice for Vets. Again, thanks for coming in. After this very short break, we'll be talking about Latinas and mental health. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Many Latina girls in Philadelphia and across the country, for that matter, are struggling with serious mental illness. A new report from the National Women's Law Project found some disturbing signs. Half of Latina high school girls in the city said they felt persistently sad and hopeless. More than 20% said they had considered suicide, and 1 in 7 had attempted suicide. And adding to the psychological stress and upset, they often felt they had no one to talk to. And while the stigma around mental health is not unusual in the United States, it's pronounced in the Latino culture, something to be ashamed of, not to be talked about. Well, we're going to break that silence today on Radio Times. What's behind this high rate of depression and suicide? How do we address the stigma that silences these girls? And what do these young people want? What do they need? We asked Noelia Rivera Calderon to join us. She's lead author of this Law Center report. It's titled, We Are Not Invisible, Latina Girls, Mental Health, and Philadelphia Schools. It has just been published, and she joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Noelia, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. You're very welcome. Also with us is Carolina Hausman-Stabile, and she's an assistant professor of social work at Bryn Mawr College. She studies Latino mental health. She's a founding member and serves on the board of directors of the Youth Suicide Research Consortium. Carolina, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Noelia, let me begin with you. What got you interested in and what made you want to work with these girls here in Philadelphia?
Yeah, so this is a report, I think, a very long time in the making. I first got interested in this just thinking about my own experience as a student in a Philadelphia school, struggling with my mental health and feeling like my school was not doing a very good job supporting me, and now learning of, you know, how different it could have been if I had gotten more support when I was in school. And then to being a teacher and seeing some of these same struggles in my own students, I had thought that this was a problem for just me. And then I was seeing that it was happening among my students. And then finally seeing these disturbing statistics that it's not just me or my students, but happening across the country. So that was really the impetus for this report.
If you don't mind me asking, what were you struggling with? What were you dealing with that really made you feel so upset, so sad, so maybe even depressed?
Sure. So I've struggled with anxiety for as long as I can remember, honestly. It got particularly severe later on in high school. So when I'm anxious, it feels kind of like my throat is closing up and I can't breathe. And then I get nauseous and because of that and have to throw up. So I would be going to school and doing that every single day, just going to school, getting so anxious that I needed to throw up. And just having the school nurse, whenever I would go to her, stop suggesting that I go home and just, you know, not really doing anything, saying it was normal. And in high school, I had my first major depressive episode as well. Wow. So in combination, I really had no energy and no motivation. I couldn't hang out with my friends. I didn't want to do anything but put my head down in class, go home and go to sleep. And it was really that I think my teachers and my counselors didn't really see what was happening, even though I think that there were some clear signs that something was wrong.
And are you better now?
I still live with anxiety and depression. I've learned to manage it much better than I did when I was in high school, thanks to, you know, having some mental health resources now that I only had barely begun to access back then. But it's not something that, you know, at least that I know of, not something that can be cured. So right now, it's something that I live with and that I'm not ashamed of, and I manage the best I can and, you know, do my best to live my life. But I know that I am only, you know, in this position where I am able to thrive because of the access to mental health treatment that I've had and that so many students don't have.
I appreciate your honesty on this. And I think it's just important to be able to say the words so that we can all understand. Carolee, let me turn to you. And as I mentioned in my introduction, there is stigma about mental illness or mental health, however you want to define it broadly, I would speaking. But is it unique to the Latino culture or more difficult in the Latino culture?
It's different in the Latino culture, especially for families that have parents or adults in charge of the family that come from places outside the United States, where access to services and mental health is much more limited. So in the United States, we have barriers to access services. We have few providers who are culturally attuned to the needs of minority clients. So when families seek services, they don't encounter in environments that are either welcoming or that they can help them because they don't understand. Mental health has a very strong cultural component. In addition to that, in some of our families, what we see is parents who have been exposed to mental health treatment in their countries of origin, which is only for the most extreme cases. So people with severe psychotic disorders who are decompensated, and the availability of treatments is not such as in the United States. So the notion that they have about what mental health is and what a person in need for mental health services might be different. Therefore, they are very scared. And they see their teenagers who are presenting anxiety or depression, and they might remember somebody in their town or in their city of origin and think, but my daughter is not behaving like the person
crazy,
I saw.
Right? It's not crazy.
Exactly. A Thurman's use is not crazy. So why does she need to see a psychiatrist? Why does she need to see a counselor?
Let me go back to you, Noelia. And in preparation for the show, I was reading about something called a good Latina. What does that mean?
I think that for so many young Latina girls, I think that oftentimes they tend to get the message that it's better to be silent about your struggles, to just do your best to deal with it on your own. You know, that's your personal problem. And also the message that we heard from a lot of students while working on this report is that they feel very judged for having mental health challenges. They feel that it's not taken seriously and that they're supposed to put others before themselves too often.
So if you're putting others before yourself, maybe in the family, you're more what responsible for family life than maybe your brother?
Yeah, that's definitely what we were hearing from a lot of students, just that they feel that they need to take on more family responsibilities and just more burdens, and also just the burden of gender-based expectations and, you know, keeping all of this inside and, you know, not wanting to be a burden on their families.
I scribbled the word expectations. Do you see it that way, Carolina?
Yes, and research has demonstrated that. So for instance, the work in Esther Calzada with early childhood expectations. So parents expect, Latino parents tend to expect that a good child will be a child that is obedient, demure, that will follow directions, and that expectations is even greater for the girls. So in the study that I participated in New York, where we interviewed over 200 Latina girls, what we consistently heard from the girls is that their parents expected that they would be well-behaved because the well-being of the family depended on them being good girls. So they could not express their distress because that will put the families that were under stress already in greater distress.
So because the burden. Right, people would judge them, or the idea of being a good girl, that would, if you were not a quote-unquote good girl, that would somehow reflect on the family or the culture, the neighborhood?
No, because you don't want your parents, who you love, to experience distress because of who you are or how you are feeling. So you're bringing a burden to your parents who might be burdened by other situations. And we know that Latino families in the United States are experiencing incredible levels of stress. Mm. So children don't want to be adding on to their parents' distress or to their siblings' distress. And also there are differential gender expectations, which is not unique to Latino culture. We see that among white women in the United States. We have to take care of the family. The expectations and the training and the socialization to roles of being the caregiver are very strong for women.
Noelle, let me go back to you, and then we've got another guest who will be joining us. Part of your report, We Are Not Invisible, talks about the political environment that we live in and the kind of stresses on Latinas and Latinos in this country because of the kind of criticism of immigrant culture or, you know, the hordes, quote unquote, coming over the Mexican border. Does that then influence a teenage girl?
I think that it absolutely does. I know that this, you know, particular challenge for Latina girls and mental health has been persistent far before the current anti-Latinx and anti-immigrant rhetoric But what we're seeing just from a review of the early existing research is that this is absolutely a factor, and it could potentially be worsening some girls' experiences. The National Women's Law Center did a survey in 2017 that found that over half of Latina girls are worried about a friend or a family member being deported, and around a quarter have been harassed since the election or, you know, made fun of because of their family's name or country of origin. So I think that there is definitely a feeling now that, I mean, people know that, you know, when the president or anybody is talking about, you know, immigrants in this very negative light, I think that girls know, you know, they're talking about me. This is my family. And an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us. And I think that, you know, I know that I have certainly mm-hmm. felt that. And mm-hmm. I think it's something we should all be concerned about.
Let me just reintroduce the two of you and get our third guest in the conversation. That's Noelia Rivera Calderon, lead author of the National Women's Law Center report. It's a brand new report, and it's titled We Are Not Invisible, Latina Girls, Mental Health, and Philadelphia Schools. She's also a fellow at the National Women's Law Center, joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Here with us in Philadelphia, Carolina Hausman-Stabile. She is an assistant professor of social work at Bryn Mawr College, studies Latino mental health, also a founding member, and serves on the board of directors of the Youth Suicide Research Consortium. And joining us now is Angela Calderon. She's a senior at El Centro de Estudiantes and a contributor to the National Women's Law Center, We Are Not Invisible. And you've been listening in. Angela, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yes. Nice to be here, you know, speaking to you.
Absolutely. And what was it like for you to work on this report?
It felt really like empowering knowing that I was able to be a part of this, and as well as, like, you know, working with the other girls that were involved in it. It felt good knowing that we got our stories out and that we were going to help other people.
Did you talk about things with the other girls in this, and including with Noelia, that you had not talked about before? Were there things that perhaps you had not felt comfortable talking about that you were able to talk about?
Honestly, I felt comfortable talking to them about everything that I previously, like, never really shared with anybody. I always felt like it really wasn't that important. And so I realized, like, it really was, like, your mental health is really important, no matter, like, who you are. So seeing the other girls tell their stories and feeling comfortable sharing mine, like, it felt really good to have that.
You had a piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer where you talked about your family. You said, we never talked about mental health in my family. Does that mean in your family you didn't talk about feelings very much?
I was able to talk to my mother about my feelings, but I kind of didn't open up much, only because, you know, my mom is very hardworking. I didn't ever want to put, like, stress on her with, like, you know, being sad and all that. So I kind of, like, kept it in. Like, once in a while, you know, I would tell her, but I never really broke it down to her and was like, I think this is serious. I kind of just, like, pushed it to the side because I felt as though it wasn't a priority at that time.
In fact, Carolina, that's exactly what you just said, is that girls, they don't want to burden their families.
Yes. And mm-hmm. the desire to help the family members to be right. Okay, and also the expectations of the parents that the girls will succeed in America are strong drivers to quiet those communications.
You talked also, Angela, about being in school and how important it felt or it was that a teacher say to the students, how are you feeling? And to ask them every morning. And I underscored that because I thought it was so simple and so basic, but so important. Can you talk about that?
Yes, because I said that because in my current school, that is how our teachers are. They always check in and ask how we are. Mm-hmm. And my previous school wasn't like that. And a lot of people don't talk about their feelings unless somebody seems like they care, or like they see that, okay, this person is going to listen. A lot of Latinas are not going to tell you how they're feeling unless they feel like you're going to care about it. They don't want to tell you something that is not going to be listened to. So having that person come up to you and, like, actually show that they care and they want to know how you feel is really important.
I mean, it sounds like it makes you visible, right, as opposed to invisible.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Noelia, you want to speak to that?
Sure. I think that one of the common themes that we saw in speaking to these students is just that they were all talking about, you know, their own challenges with mental health and their desire to succeed in school and to go far in their lives, but feeling like even if they are breaking the stigma and, you know, not being silent and asking for help, that it's being met with either ignorance or resistance. We heard from too many of our students that they feel judged by their teachers and counselors, that they are made to feel ashamed, and that so much of this is happening in school, and that so much is that even the role of stereotypes is playing a role, that how people think Latina girls are supposed to be moody or dramatic or fiery, and that's just how they are, rather than seeing these things as potential mental health challenges. And this whole culture of stereotyping, stigma, and shame is what pushes students into feeling invisible.
In fact, Angela, in that piece you wrote for The Inquirer, you said that girls like you thought of as, quote-unquote, spicy.
Yes, I said that because, like, a lot of Latinas have a very strong personality, and, you know, a lot of people think that it's normal to, like, kind of have, like, you know, that little bipolarness to them where they're... you know, I'm saying that with quotes around it because that's how other people see it, like where you're very snappy and you're very opinionated and loud. And that's not always the case. And sometimes these things are, like, serious. It's not just, you know, a personality trait. It's something that needs to be addressed and that some people don't even feel comfortable, like, speaking on it because people are going to be like, well, that's just how you are. That's how Latinas are. And, like, it shouldn't be like that.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Angela Calderon. She's a senior at El Centro de Estudiantes, a contributor to the National Women's Law Center's We Are Not Invisible, Latina Girls, Mental Health, and Philadelphia Schools. Noelia Rivera Calderon, lead author of this report. She's also a fellow at the National Women's Law Center. And with us here in Philadelphia, Carolina Hausman-Stabile. She's assistant professor of social work at Bryn Mawr College. She studies Latino mental health. A founding member, serves on the board of directors of the Youth Suicide Research Consortium. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us, WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoin, talking with our guests about what to do about the mental health crisis among Latina girls, young Latina women, both here in Philadelphia, but across the country. And I'm quoting actually from this new study called We Are Not Invisible, Latina Girls, Mental Health, and Philadelphia Schools, written in part with our two guests, Noelia Rivera Calderon and Angela Calderon, no relation that I know of. But let me just quote a couple of things that these young girls say. This is Yvonne, who is at Esperanza Academy Charter School, ninth grade, 15 years old. People say, get over it. It's not that bad. Just move on. They don't stop and ask, what have you been going through? They just say, get over it. Another student from another school who's 18. I see all these posts on social media about Black girls and Hispanic girls that were kind of crazy. I feel like for us, they see us as just crazy. But if a white girl's acting crazy, they think that something is really wrong. For us, oh no, she's crazy. Also another girl saying mental health is always put into a negative light. People judge you and it's not something you can control. These are very powerful and moving words coming from young people. Angela, you're one of these young people. Anything you want to add to that?
Like a lot of people, the stereotypes I think were the biggest thing, like just people just assuming that all of us are crazy. I think that needs to be emphasized because that shouldn't be normalized at all. Being bipolar is serious and that should not be joked around a lot. A lot of people, they get used to it and they start to believe it and they're like, okay, well, I'm just bipolar. Like, I have emotions. And, like, you know, I don't think mental health is something like to play around with, especially when there's so many of us going through the same thing.
Yeah. I hear you. Carolina, let me get you back in on the conversation. How do we address these stereotypes and also the stigma?
So we need to have a real conversation as a nation of how we are talking about important segments of the population. We don't talk only poorly about Latinas, but we talk about other racial and ethnic minorities or cultural minorities, and really generate awareness that when we talk about these groups, the words carry weight in how they feel and impact their health and their performance. So we are talking about girls in a critical moment in their developmental trajectory. This is a time where they are transitioning and making big decisions that will result in their contribution to our society. So,
and it's adolescence. I mean, it's not hard for anybody, but these are added pressures.
I think that it's so important to become aware that this is a moment where life is ahead of you and where you have hopes and dreams. What is happening with this group of girls that they are seeing at this point in their lives, that life is not worth living, and that the suffering of living is so tremendous that perhaps death is a solution. Mm-hmm. What are we doing as a society? So my question is really reckoning with the consequences of how we treat minority members of our communities, not how we treat, how we fund their schools, how we fund their mental health programs, how do we talk about them in the press, how we present them in shows, what do we say about them? And also understanding what kind of society are we producing that kids are not feeling that life is worth living.
Yeah, I mean, that's just so profound and so disturbing. And it you know, what teenagers, young people, they know what's going on in the culture, and they absorb it.
Yes, and this is a moment where also developmentally kids become more aware of their context outside their families. So they see their parents stressed. 37% of Mexican-American kids, meaning American kids who have been born in the country, so they are American, but they are of Mexican origin, live under the line of poverty. Yeah. So their families are stressed. And now they are becoming aware because the secret of perhaps immigrational status of beloved family members, maybe siblings, maybe their caregivers, maybe a cousin, maybe they're fearing that they are going to be taken away and what is going to happen to them. At 15, 14, kids are becoming aware of these issues. And also they are understanding that they are attending schools that are underfunded, and their expectation is that to succeed in America, you have to succeed educationally. So the burden that we place on this very large segments of our population, sure, are very high, and we cannot expect kids at that age to be able to handle them. It's the adult's responsibility.
Noelia, let me go back to you and let me read the very beginning of this We Are Not Invisible report. Latina girls have big dreams. 98% want to graduate from high school. 85% are interested in college. 69% are interested in graduate school. Just to put our conversation into a larger context, when those dreams are, if not dashed, but questioned, what is the impact?
I think it's an enormous impact. We decided to focus on schools because we do see this as the key to so many things, and where students spend so much time, and where the course of your life really is set. And we know that Latina girls have big dreams. But we also know that mental health challenges can make those dreams harder to achieve. And I feel that we're not really, just as a society at the whole, looking at the impact of mental health on education. We know that, for example, one of our findings is that Latina girls nationwide are much less likely than white girls to be identified as needing disability accommodations in school, despite all of these challenges that they're facing. For our own report, we talked to 21 students who were all, you know, open about the challenges they experienced. Not a single one of them had ever received any type of accommodation in their schools. So if it becomes hard to succeed because of these mental health challenges, then that can put college into question, career into question. If you're not receiving the accommodations that you're legally entitled to and just don't know about, that makes it really hard. Latina women still have an incredibly quite large wage gap, making only, I think, around 53 cents to every dollar that a white man makes. And I think that we have to look at the role of education in setting up these lifelong consequences and how supporting mental health is a part of supporting education.
Let me go back to you, and we're talking about Philadelphia schools here, and you've been a teacher, Noelia, so you have been through the kind of budget crises that so many schools in this city have been through. Has that exacerbated the problem as you see it?
Yes, I think so. I think that part of it is, yes, we are not funding our schools as if our students matter, period. That is a huge problem in Philadelphia right now and in districts across the country. But I also think that every time that we have the opportunity to make choices about the budget and what we fund, it's important to be mindful of what we are funding. Are we funding more school policing, or are we funding more counselors? What is our vision of where this money should go and what the role of a school should be? So absolutely, we need more funding for counselors, social workers, training, all of these recommendations that we lay out in the report. Mm-hmm. But it's important to also look at where existing funding is going, and are we treating student mental health like it matters in the way we spend our money?
Angela, let me get you back in on the conversation here. You're a senior at El Centro de Estudiantes. Talk about the kind of mental health needs that you and other students need.
I think counselors are the biggest thing, as well as having our teachers well equipped to deal with mental health as well, because our teachers are who we spend the most time with. You don't see, you know, your counselors every day. A lot of counselors are part-time. There's some schools that don't even have counselors anymore. And it's really important that the people around us, even if they aren't, you know, specifically a counselor, they should be able to be someone we can go to and talk to if we ever need it.
What kind of training do you think teachers need? And I'm sure some teachers listening to us are saying, oh, my gosh, you know, I got to get these students on grade and also deal with their mental health.
I don't think you need any type of, like, big training. You just have to be aware of what's going on, and you have to know that everybody's different and people go through things. You have to be very understanding and supportive. I think that's the main thing with who, like, our adults that we're with every day. They need to be, like, supportive and, you know, be there for us. That's just the main thing.
Which gets back to your question about being asked every day, how are you feeling? I mean, it sounds like that would go a long way.
Yes, definitely. I'm really grateful to have that in my current school. My previous school, like I said, they weren't reaching out to students about things like that because they didn't really notice and they didn't think that was, like, you know, their priority. It was like college prep school. So, you know, you're getting ready to go to college. Sure. You have to work. And, you know, sometimes a lot of students were overwhelmed. And besides other things that probably are going on at home, a lot of students got overwhelmed, and there's normal, but they don't feel like they can talk about it because, again, you have, like, you know, your priorities seem to just be school first. Like, mental health should be the first thing.
I hear you. Carolina, what should teachers look for?
So many teachers feel already burdened by the amount of expectations on them. But I think that what Angelica is pointing out is very important, the sense of creating spaces of belonging for every student. And creating these ideas or these practices within the classroom that allow kids to communicate with each other and foster a space where people feel that they belong in there, given that many Latino kids don't feel that they belong in the United States or that they are not welcome. So practices like asking how are you doing and helping students become attuned to each other, they are the best and first line of communication of trouble. They say, my friend, no, I noticed something. You know, generating communication among students and with the adults in charge of taking care. We know that the number one predictor of suicidal behaviors among adolescents, Latinas and non-Latinas, is conflict in the family and the sense of alienation from others, the sense of loneliness that carries upon hopelessness. Not only am I facing tremendous struggle, but I'm alone, and nobody is there to help me or mentor me. So creating spaces that can make kids feel that they belong.
Noelia, in this report, it does talk about peer support groups. I mean, the value of that, and that seemed to be what a number of the young people thought would be important and valuable in a school.
Yeah, that was something that the students completely, you know, brought to us on their own, and that's how it made it into the report. So it was truly co-authored with the students. Peer support circles is something that I have done with Latina middle school girls when I was a teacher, and it was just huge just to have a space where girls feel like they can trust each other and build community and talk about what's going on in their lives. I was able to do that as part of time set aside for advisory, and but it was something that, you know, with changing schedules school year to school year, it was hard to continue. But I saw just the incredible value that that has. And I think that it's something that every school should not only make time for, but train teachers in how to facilitate these peer support circles.
So it was carving out a time during the day or during the week where students could come and sit and talk together with you?
Yes, exactly.
Angela, have you been able to participate in something like that?
Yes. I had a teacher in my current school who did a circle every morning and would check in and ask each student how they felt and would go around. And a lot of the teachers in my school actually still do that every day, or they try to do it at least a couple times in the week if they can't do it every day. Just, you know, to check in again with the students and see how they're doing besides, you know, schoolwork and all of that. Like, and it became like a very supportive space. Like, at first, I was kind of nervous, like, talking to, you know, a bunch of people I wasn't familiar with about my feelings, you know, when I began school. But after a while, I became really comfortable, and everybody, like, was very comfortable with each other, and we all supported each other and were very, like, motivational. If somebody was having a bad day, we would be there for them. We would ask them what they needed. And it was always, like, it became like a family.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm looking at you, Caroline, and we're smiling because what a wonderful thing.
Yes, and we see this across different groups that are struggling with issues. At the beginning, the first speaker talking about the importance of meeting people who had similar experiences and finding that your voices or your experiences are not unique. And now with Latinas, the importance of creating spaces where people feel understood and embraced is critical for mental health outcomes.
Let me just add one more thing. Something I've read about called ACE, or Adverse Childhood Experiences. It's actually a kind of a scoring system about just what are the adverse experiences that a child is experiencing, and that helps you to understand what they might be going through.
Yes, and also the aggregated value the aggregated impact of multiple adverse experiences. So we know that Latino children in the country, for instance, are reporting more experiences of being bullied. So schools are not safe, and that they feel threatened in the public space walking to school, that they are experiencing more conflict with their parents, that they are experiencing financial stressors, that kids are witnessing domestic violence or are victims of violence. So the compounded effect of all those negative experiences on a vulnerable, developing human being and how it impacts their sense of value of being themselves and being able to regulate and being able to understand how to handle stressful situations that are new, and as to trust in others for guidance and mentorship during those stressful times.
Noelia, we're almost out of time. I'm giving you the last word. And any final thoughts before we say goodbye?
I think my final thing that I want people to take away from this is to look to students as experts more often. I think that
you're here.
Yeah. I think that it's easy to get into a pattern of, oh my God, this is a problem, and, you know, not focus on students who know what works for them. And I think Angela has given, I think Angela is a great example of that, her experience of being first in an unsupportive school and then in a supportive school and being able to say exactly what works. So I think, yeah, that's my takeaway. Let's listen to our students and trust that they know what they're talking about.
Well, Noelia, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
And that's Noelia Rivera Calderon, again, lead author of this report from the National Women's Law Center titled We Are Not Invisible, Latina Girls, Mental Health, and Philadelphia Schools. She's a fellow at the National Women's Law Center. Angela Calderon, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And good luck to you as well. I know you're a senior at El Centro de Estudiantes, a contributor to this report. And Carolina Hausman, Constabile, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's an assistant professor of social work at Bryn Mawr College. I'm Marty Moskowing. Thank you so much for joining us.